accepting luxuries for those who can afford them, and freedoms for those who disagree. On Last Impressions 33, I'm Justin Katz. So as you can hear, I'm having one of those days just getting over a cold and, you know, those kind of illnesses where you wish, hey, I wish I could keep this voice. It's kind of got more character than my usual one. This week, a friend of mine who had occasion to accompany somebody to a local hospital told me about how concierge-like the services were. It was almost like being at a luxury hotel in Las Vegas or something, trying to make people comfortable and keep them updated with automated ways of informing them of where in the system the loved one was, as far as operations and so on and so forth. And this person was really impressed. And what it got me thinking about was, imagine you could pay extra for this. Imagine it were a luxury hospital, and people who could afford it could pay more and get that extra level of service. How quickly do you think it would take for people, particularly progressives, but others as well, to get this sense of fairness? It's just not fair. Everybody ought to get the same healthcare services. And I, thinking in these terms, struck me that that's kind of how we trip ourselves up, I think, and our sense of fairness and the urge to even all playing fields kind of shuts down what you might call a life cycle of innovation. I mean, these things, whether it's TVs or healthcare or what have you, they start at the top for people who have extra money. The innovators are trying to capture that extra money. And here's where I think the error starts. Companies have incentive to expand their customer base, not restrict it. Companies aren't saying, you know what, why don't we just stay? I mean, well, some do because it's they don't want to kill their brand, but a Rolls Royce or what have you. But for the most part, on items that can be expanded, that aren't sold as luxury goods per se, the incentive, whether it's TVs, healthcare, whatever, is to find new customers, to identify what's essential in this luxury service. What is it that makes it seem so special? And can we do it a little differently? Can we be more efficient at it to bring down the price so that we can get more consumers? This is the incentive in economics. So if you had a hospital in which there were these luxury goods and services and people seemed to want them, the hospitals would start to try to, how do we knock that down to a price point that the next level of customers can afford? And in this way, you end up eventually where everybody has a smartphone, for example. This is how that works. And our urge to get fairness now and not allow anything unfair to happen is really an urge to stifle progress, because somebody is going to be the first person to have something, right? And when things are new, they're expensive, so only people can really afford them will be able to get them. That's just how it has to happen. How things have to happen is something we have trouble tolerating in our society, I think it seems. Rhode Island Public Radio, 2 weeks ago probably, by the time I catch up in my podcast listening, they had on, again, Senate Finance Chairman William Conley, and he was talking about things like the Paul Sox stadium deal they're pushing now, that the Rhode Island Senate Finance Committee is really having promotional hearings, trying to get the public used to the idea. And they were also talking about things like corporate handouts. And Scott McKay, a pretty left-wing commentator for Rhode Island Public Radio, made this point.
The lure of Boston, as we see from GE, we need to work with companies moving to Boston, not think we're going to compete against Boston. They're a major league venue. They have major league high-tech job workforce there, and they are major league sports teams with a AAA franchise. It doesn't mean we can't get some spillover.
Let's put aside the notion of, whether Rhode Island can compete with Boston, the Boston area. And let's put aside also the idea of we, meaning the government, basically, and those the government satellites, like commentators, we can compete with Boston and not the people of Rhode Island. Let's put all that aside and focus on this spillover idea. You only get spillover on something if you are the best place to go within a certain framework. So if a company wants to be a certain distance from Boston, there's a radius that they'll tolerate, and that's what Rhode Island would benefit from. And so the question is Rhode Island the best place within that radius, let's say the tip of Connecticut, large parts of less urban Massachusetts, you got New Hampshire and Maine, in that radius, if you want spillover, you have to be the most attractive area. And we're not that. Governor Raimondo is trying to make us that by offering handouts and special deals to companies like General Electric. Hey, give us a little sliver of your company and we'll give you huge incentive to bring you here. You can do that, I guess. But on a larger scale, you need to free up your economy. That's what, when people are sitting in Boston saying, you know what, we need to expand a little bit out of this city for whatever reason, or this is too expensive here, let's find somewhere less expensive. They'll look at that radius and say, hey, look, New Hampshire doesn't have a bunch of taxes. There's no income tax up there. Or it could be Rhode Island. Hey, Rhode Island has a really great business environment. That'd be a great place within a quick jump to Boston that we could expand. Instead of giving, essentially buying them off, bribing them to ignore how bad things are here with handouts to special corporations. So if you build your state on this idea of corporate handouts and also welfare, friendliness to illegal immigration, all this stuff, if that's what you're friendly with, then you'll get spillover for that. And, you know, that's exactly what we saw with 38 Studios, the gaming company from a Major League Baseball player. Those people who can't get the corporate handouts they want in Massachusetts and Boston, then that makes Rhode Island attractive. You get that spillover. If you're attracting for illegal immigration and welfare benefits, that's the spillover you want to get. And these are not sustainable ways of growing your population or your economy. But the problem is our elite's whole attitude is built on not seeing people in this way, you know, as autonomous, self-directing entities. And there was a small indication of that lacking perspective. Being a language guy, I and this drives some of my coworkers crazy, but I focus on words and what they mean, not even what they should mean by their denotation or definition, but also where their origin is. A lot of times people don't even know the origin. I remember when I was young, I still a teenager, I think, and I encountered somebody from a different region, and it had just been a saying, you know, the phrase Indian giver. And I had never thought about where that phrase might come from. And when I used that in the context of somebody in the presence of somebody who had never heard it before, suddenly I went, oh, wait, this is not good. There are other ones I hear all the time. Like, I've heard parents in the company of their small children talking about a circle jerk, you know, things like that. So a lot of people, you don't think of that, of what the phrase actually is, the image is supposed to be that comes to your head when you hear that. They think of it as just a blah, blah, blah. It could be any few syllables meaning something. It has a connotation or a word like when you use that all the time. It's not meaning what it means. It means, you know, sort of what you're trying to convey. But so there was one phrase in this clip from Governor Raimondo on Newsmakers coming up that triggered that reaction in me. Here it is. So she's talking about the closure of Benny's and all the employees that'll now have to find work.
I mean, my heart goes out. If you're a 50-year-old store manager at Benny's, what are you going to do now? We got to find you a job. You know, my DLT was in there the very next Monday, because we're going to make sure you get a job. We're going to get you into a job training program. We're going to get you skills you need. And we're going to retool you for a new job.
We're going to retool you like you're some adaptable machine. Don't even worry about what your hopes and dreams are. Don't worry about what you want to do. we're going to come in, we're going to take some of your screws out and add some attachments, and we're going to retool you. So you are no longer a machine for stocking shelves, but a machine for doing something else that some company has worked with government insiders to have you able to do. I dislike these dehumanizing words. We're going to retool you. But I get the feeling, don't you too, get the feeling that for a lot of people in government, a lot of the people who think we need central planning, that's kind of their thought, is people are just automatons. We'll set you up. Well, you know, you're some poor 50-year-old guy. We don't know what you, maybe, you know, maybe Benny's was holding you back. Maybe the steadiness of the job was keeping you from moving on to something spectacular. Now we're going to retool you, and then you can do what we think you ought to do. While I'm talking about Raimondo on Newsmaker, though, I wanted to quickly touch on this because it did catch my attention. Talking about Obamacare, Bernie Care, Trump Care. Here it is.
I'm wondering how you feel about single payer. Do you support Bernie Sanders' bill?
I am not smart enough on his bill to tell you.
How about the
if
premise?
I support it. But the concept I do support. Look, what we have now doesn't work. We spend way too much money on administration. There's too many payers, and the payers have too much power in the system.
So this politician has been opining on GOP proposals that she clearly hasn't read for a year now. And yet she doesn't want to comment on Bernie Sanders' plan because until she understands the details. On this one, she wants to wait for details. The other ones, you know, not so much. She was willing to just go forward with the Democrat talking points. But more important, she said, what we have now, meaning Obamacare, doesn't work. I mean, wasn't Obamacare supposed to be the fix? Are they now admitting that we were all right to say this is supposed to fail so that they can implement single payer? You know, it's hard not to come to that conclusion, especially with such absurd statements like administration under the current system is too expensive. And what, putting it in government is going to make it more efficient? When does that ever happen? That's crazy. And what about this idea? My favorite part of that clip was there are too many payers, which I don't know what that means. I mean, ideally, everybody should be paying for their own health care. And then you have too many payers because, as she says, the payers have control. When you pay for your own something, healthcare, landscaping, whatever you might pay for, you have the control. You get to say, this is what I want to pay for. This is what I want you to do if you want me to pay for it. But the idea that there are too many payers is crazy too. And then the idea that we have this system where the payers have too much control. So what do we want to do? We want to give it to government, to politicians, to people who have access to everything else in our lives, from taxation, who can put you in jail, shoot you. We want government, the centralized bureaucracy of self-interested politicians. That's the payer we want to give all this too much control to. If anybody is listening with even the slightest bit of awareness and open-mindedness to the way the politicians talk about single payer and other progressive policies when they come up, when they don't have something, a card to read off right in front of them, think about it. I mean, it gets frightening. So also this week, I got into an argument on Facebook about the most important news of the day, which is that football players are kneeling during the national anthem. And the argument online was whether the football players are the ones politicizing the sport. Now, somebody I didn't know, who a friend of a friend, who, in a Facebook sense, that is, somebody who appeared to be, she gave me the impression of being progressive. She sure did say a lot of progressive type things. But she was insisting that everything is political. The decision to respect the anthem, to stand for it as everybody else does, that's political, she was saying. And, you know, it's one of those arguments like, all right, you know, fine. You know, at that level, sure. Yeah. Okay. The decision to respect other people's opinions and to value, you know, sort of respectful unity and the values of the United States, the things for which the flag stands and the things the anthem stirs, should stir in us all to respect that kind of a unity under one nation. Yeah, that's a high-level political decision. We don't have to do that. We don't have to be respectful of other people's opinions. We don't have to try to be unified under basic principles of governance, the idea of the United States. But those who want players to stand during a national anthem, if that's the rule, if they've been doing that, you know, whether it was 2009 when that was implemented, and as I said on that in that argument, if, hey, I'm willing to accept that the Obama administration and the Democrat Congress pushed too hard with their jingoism to force the NFL players to be on the field for the national anthem, but that's the thing now. I mean, it's been a decade about they stand. So that's the consensus that we've come to at this point. And so the people who want the players to stand, they're requesting unity within the political idea of the country. Whereas those who support them kneeling, when they kneel, they're advocating unity at some smaller level. Now, that could be the unity within the team or this whole industry of highly paid entertainers. They could be talking about unity within certain racial groups or with certain racial groups or, you know, on the political issue itself, the Black Lives Matter type stuff, or even anti-Trumpism, which seems to be part of it now, too. These types of unity are all more narrow than unity within our entire country and its political ideals. That is the essence of politicization. If you just say everything is politicized, everything is political, then it means it's meaningless. So, but this does show the danger of allowing sort of the baseline ideas on which we must agree within the country, allowing those to expand. I mean, then at that point, you're deciding what gets in, and you're no longer talking unifying principles of a country. You're talking about narrow political issues. And this strikes me, especially with the president talking with a bold speech before the UN, this gets to an irony, I think, when it comes to globalization. So, I mean, if you step back and just into practical political terms, the left works, it sort of works its way into being a de facto anti-American when you pull back and look at the global view. I mean, they'll express support versus their own country for regimes that do 10 times worse things than the things they fault conservative Americans for doing. You know, they supported Russia until it looked like Trump might, until that became a convenient way to distract from Hillary's own crimes. Or they'll support Iran or North Korea even. So they're happy to express support for regimes that do terrible, terrible things, provided that those terrible countries can be positioned domestically in opposition to conservative Americans. So as you watch this over the years and decades, the impression you get is that these leftists actually oppose America. And they oppose America more than they're faulting us for our transgressions. Like this woman on Facebook saying, "I love my country. I want it to improve." Well, you know, it's kind of like the analogy I used, she didn't seem to appreciate very much, was if you're a woman who can't believe that other women don't recoil from your husband in disgust at his obesity or something like that, you can't then turn around and say, "Well, I love my husband very much. I just want him to improve." No, you don't really like your husband very much. You're disgusted by him. You're disgusted by your country. You'll side with other countries that do worse things in the category of things that you say are important because you're opposed to a certain faction in your country. Now, the way, in contrast to this, the way to get to global unity on core issues like human rights or even national unity in that respect, I think a good way to get there is to follow the Catholic concept of solidarity, where, you know, we have to consider each other one human race under God in the Catholic context, which I believe, by the way. And that, so we have solidarity. We're not unrelated. Everybody is your neighbor. We're not unrelated in that regard. But there's an important companion concept in the Catholic worldview of subsidiarity, which is that you you make decisions and force things and do take action at the lowest level possible, the most personal level possible. You don't try to make everything a declaration from Rome or from the UN. You try to get it down. And that's very much in line with the American approach of federalism. I mean, I've talked to people locally, you know, because in Rhode Island, everybody hates the property tax and everybody wants more state aid. And I think that's backwards. I think you ought to increase local taxes and have the municipalities send money to the state for services. I think, and then the state, as it was originally designed, the states get together and put together the federal government. And that's the way it ought to work. Subsidiarity. You ought to start with the subsidiary, with the smallest thing, not the other, not this top-down imposition. So let's say that we start with the idea that our core ideal at the national level, the thing that unites us all, and which everybody within the United States has to agree, is a respect for other people's views. Now, as particular issues come up, you know, whether in this case it be, I guess, police treatment of minorities, we should have national conversations, and we should have those in venues where people expect to have national conversations, not in venues meant to pull us together collegially, culturally, socially, as a nation. Sports events, you know, we pick teams, we're opponents in that regard, but we're all there ignoring our differences and looking at the game. That's not where you put the national conversation. And what happens when you respect other people's views and you have shared spaces for cultural exchange that don't bring in the politicization, you wind up with people around the country having very different policies at the local and state level. And those local policies really do, or much more do, express the values of people, very different people, who are allowed to live in the world that they want to live in and be governed by the type of government they want to be governed by. You're going to get those very different views. When you do that, you can work together on core national values and strengthen them. And this attitude can expand outward. So the United Nations, in this view, would be a much smaller organization focused on coordinating truly universal values, not trying to talk about land use or global warming or whatever else they might talk about. That should be there to expand our ability to respect each other in our own spaces and expand truly human universal values like freedom, to increase the amount of freedom, not by imposing it, by saying you can't have this form of government in every small detail, but drawing people in, giving them an alternative, interacting with them over time, years, decades, centuries if necessary. Now, the first problem with implementing such a radical idea, right, is that it takes confidence in the ideas. You have to be able to go into this forum and say, look, I'm going to respect your different views because I know in the long run mine is better and you're not going to overtake that with yours. And it also takes trust in people, faith in people, that when they see the better idea, they will gravitate toward it. That's the first problem, and why I think a lot of times we don't go in this direction. The second problem, much more practical and perhaps much more influential in preventing global unity, is that the larger the reach of the organization, the more attractive it is to the kinds of people who want to tell other people what to do. And so when you throw into this this excuse, this idea that not acting is just as political as acting. So when you don't stop the tyrant from doing something, you're allowing him to do it. If you don't force this other country to start a recycling program or sterilize its people, you're really doing the opposite. You are aiding and abetting their destruction of the world. So if not acting is the same as acting, Well, you know, you might as well impose your views wholesale on other people. And that doesn't allow working together because the other person knows you're not respecting their space. You're not giving them any way to interact with you where they're not trying to force something down your throat. The equivalence between acting and allowing action, in other words, makes it impossible to interact at all because you can't do anything with people. You can't normalize Trump, as they say, right? I mean, that's a good image for this. If you even hang out with him or say something nice about him or respect some kind of space of his, then you're normalizing him, and that's bad. We can't do that. Well, now you can't work with him or his supporters, right? That's kind of what those folks want on the left, but I'm trying to drive home this idea. And another consequence, of course, is if that's your attitude, the other person has to accept your own personal minimum of what our shared values are. So you're really just telling that person, no, let me tell you what our shared values have to be. And I'm not going to work with you unless you meet this minimum threshold. Even if there are things we can work on, no, we're not going to do it because you have to meet my minimum threshold. I will not tolerate your intolerance, as it goes. So I don't know where this comes from. Sometimes you get the impression that the left just assumes that people want to work together. Most of the time, though, I think that it's just they want power and whatever they say in any given time is to gain more power. But I'd say, you know, let's preserve our shared spaces and our ability to define an area that is non-political within the universal political on which we've been able to agree, right? Let's make that political decision to respect each other's spaces and then have places we can go, or I'm sorry, the universal value to respect each other's opinions and rights. And then we will have spaces we can go and not be political. And then, yes, if you kneel during a national anthem, you're the one politicizing that. All right, because we agreed on a certain number of values. And those are represented emblematically by the flag, by the anthem, and you are disrespecting that. So you are the one. You know, you're free to do that in a governmental sense. We're not going to lock you up for it. But you are, admit it, you're the one politicizing this issue. In this regard, just as a kind of closing statement on this particular topic, I wanted to throw in something that Glenn Reynolds wrote on Instapundit the other day as I was putting this together, or yesterday as I was putting this together, that seemed apropos. And so this is a somewhat longish quote from Glenn Reynolds. He writes, "If you make people hyper aware of their differences, as is done on college campuses today, you can make things much worse than they otherwise would be. If you encourage people to think about what they have in common, you can make things much better. And where it suits their interests, politicians will create ethnic cleavages. My prediction, that is, Glenn Reynolds, is that if you created some sort of racially segregated society, politicians would soon be at work finding other differences to inflame, differences that nobody's even aware of now. The only real answer is a strong social norm that supports, for example, our common humanity, and in this country, our common Americanness." So let me jump to something that's not entirely unrelated. This is Econ Talk with Russ Robert. And his guest is Philip Auerswald from George Mason University. And they're talking about, well, it's kind of a broad-ranging conversation, but in this particular clip I'm going to play, Rush Robert is talking about urbanization and its interaction with opposition to the other and the global scenario, the global community. So give this a look. This is Russ Roberts talking right here.
You'd think it'd be the people in London, which is a very cosmopolitan city, has a wide range of people of color from all over the world in it, has a bunch of languages being spoken that you can't miss, has service people who, even though they speak English, speak it with a non-British accent and a non-American accent because they were born in Eastern Europe or in somewhere around the Mediterranean or somewhere far away. And yet, It's the people in the countryside who don't mingle with those people who feel like we're, quote, losing our country. Our country is not the same as it was before. The character of Britain, of England, is not being preserved. They don't even interact much with those folks, with the people they're upset about, the immigration and the people moving across borders. You'd think it'd be the people in London who would be dismayed at how the city has changed. Why are the people who aren't living there dismayed? That seems weird.
Now, Rush Robert is by no stretch progressive, at least that I've noticed and listened to his show. But, you know, maybe it's not about our superficial differences. You know, maybe people are generally tolerant of other people, their skin color, based on skin color, accent, whatever. Maybe that's a stand-in for other things, other concerns. And in that, if you take that perspective, cities, well, they kind of are the other. I mean, on a low end, you've got, you know, lower income immigrants or people who come here without a whole lot of resources and want to, in order to build up their lives. They come in and they're carrying a lot of the culture of their other country. That's within the city. And then you've got the global elite on the high end who, you know, with technology, both information technology and transportation technology, really are able to live in a sort of global community that's more disconnected from the people who live next door than people in far distant cities. So these two things come together and they make cities different, connected to places that are different from the country that, in which they're located, their state or the country, whatever. That's fine. And if we had this subsidiarity I was talking about before, that would be no issue whatsoever because, as Rush Roberts kind of pointing out here, people are actually tolerant. They're not going to care that the folks in the city are different than in the country. They've always been different. There have always been even bigger differences than racial differences between the city people and the country people. That's not new. The problem is, and where this global, the immigration and the global jet set, where that becomes key is that the powerful governing classes, the elites, they're using the city's population and economic power within a democracy and within a regional economy to change the laws for the country. And this is why something like trade and immigration were huge issues for Trump, for President Trump, because that is what engenders the resentment. People don't care. They'll talk about it. They'll notice differences where they seem relevant, but people don't really care if the folks in the city are darker or if they speak with accents or even if they're rich. What they care about is that those people are not, you're using that their advantages to make my life different where I am and not respect my right to subsidiarity. That is the big difference. So it's the progressivism, the central planning, the idea of locating all decisions from a little hub, so whether it's Washington, D.C., going out to the major cities, going out to the suburbs and the rural areas, it's planning going down. That is the problem. And that's what I've got to say this week. Thanks for listening. Tune in, as I've said. I'm now on iTunes. I'm getting elsewhere as well. I'm putting these things up on ricochet.com, so you can go there, leave comments, and like it there, which will force them to promote this on their main stream. Of course, you'll have to join in order to do that. iTunes too. I'm looking for other ways to get out there. Always looking for feedback. And in the meantime, God bless. And remember, don't worry too much about your first impressions. They come and go, but your last impressions might last forever.
I love the light and I the love, hanging on with push and shove. Position is the motivation that is hanging up. Left wing nation looks like we always end up